because they're close to problems and close proximity to those problems, they come up with the most, I think, feasible solutions. And then it's our job as leaders in terms of creating culture to help either figure out how to scale that solution or augment that solution or break down any impediments that exist in terms of getting that to market, if you will, and making it a workable solution for the unit.
Welcome to the Digital Warfighting Series with CENTCOM. Hondo Gertz and Lauren Badula here. We're co-hosts of Building the Base, but doing a special series with U.S. CENTCOM to explore components of digital warfighting that they're pursuing and looking to modernize. And today's episode will be focused specifically on the digital side of counter-UAS, which is an incredibly important focus for the command. And no one better than Colonel Molly Salisbury to talk us through it. Colonel Salisbury, thanks so much for joining us today.
Awesome. Thanks so much for both of you for having me and for doing this with CENTCOM. You guys are both obviously renowned in your field, and it's just great to be here to talk to you today.
Yeah, it's great to see you, Molly. And for those who don't know, Molly commands the 513th Military Intelligence Brigade, which is a pretty awesome and important job. We'll get into that job a little bit. But Molly, just for our listeners, a little background. What got you into the Army? What set you down on this path? And how does one go from growing up somewhere to now be commanding such an awesome unit as the 513th?
Well, sir, that's kind of I think I have a pretty normal story, if you will. I think that I, like a lot of American kids, was probably looking for a way to pay for school. I grew up in Orlando, Florida. I worked at Disney World. I was kind of thinking about, you know, how am I going to pay for school, and saw some ROTC information, and it seems like a great opportunity. And so here I am kind of 20 some years later. but I think just somewhere along the way, I kind of fell in love with the team aspect of it and the mission, certainly. And Intel is a very cool thing to do. So as soon as I got into the Army, 9/11 kicked off and I got an opportunity to do Intel in the field and to work with just such high performing soldiers from conventional Army to the special operations side and Intel sort of in at the ground level at all of those things, both at the strategic level all the way to down to the tactical level. I've gotten a chance to kind of work in a lot of different spaces and meet a lot of different faces. And I think every year I'm in, I'm just feel more fortunate for the exposure and the opportunities and the people that I've met.
And you're now at Fort Eisenhower. So give our listeners a little thought of what the 513th does and kind of where your focus is and mission, kind of what the scope of that activity is.
Yeah, the 513th is located primarily in Fort Eisenhower, as you mentioned. That's right in Augusta, Georgia. I love Fort Eisenhower because there's so many awesome nerds here. We have a lot of military intelligence teammates, both our brigade and a couple others. And then we also have the Cyber Center of Excellence is here. And so you have a lot of signal, cyber, and intel soldiers. And so that just brings about a very kind of creative mix. But most days, 513th is focused very much on the Middle East and on the CENTCOM area of responsibility, which is why I'm talking to you today. So we are CENTCOM's Theater Intelligence Brigade. Our headquarters is the Army Central Command, and they're located at Shaw Air Force Base, just about just over a two-hour drive from here. But most of the time we're all located, or portions of us are located in theater. So my boss, I think most days, General Frank, is in theater in either Kuwait or Jordan or Saudi or Iraq or Syria. And so same with our soldiers. We're spread out throughout the entire CENTCOM AOR, much like our CENT and CENTCOM are.
Well, Molly, you've built a reputation around being such an effective leader for innovation. I know Skye was telling us that she looks to you for inspiration in this space. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about how you think about fostering a culture of innovation, or really trying to encourage folks to embrace new solutions, try new things, approach the problems that you're focused on.
So I'm first just extremely honored that Skye would say that, because we all look to Skye for inspiration. And she's been incredibly impressive and both extremely down to earth to work with, but also I think really willing to listen to the people with the problems. And so that's the first thing I'd say, is that to inspire the culture, we have to start with our people, our operators, our analysts, our collectors, our agents. And in Intel, it's our collectors, agents, and analysts primarily that are close to problems. And so because they're close to problems and close proximity to those problems, they come up with the most, I think, feasible solutions. And then it's our job as leaders in terms of creating culture to help either figure out how to scale that solution or augment that solution or break down any impediments that exist in terms of getting that to market, if you will, and making it a workable solution for the unit. So I think that's the biggest thing is first listen to the people that are closest to the problem. As leaders, empower those people by trying to clear hurdles for them and clear space for them to succeed. And then I think the other thing I would say is that in terms of creating that culture, I have been extraordinarily fortunate in my life that as I've spent a lot of time in special operations, the thing that struck me is the empowerment of our NCOs and our warrant officers. And as I came into brigade command here, I was absolutely struck by how many incredible NCOs we have, both from, you know, all the way from the Sergeant E5 level up to our Sergeant Major. I was getting ready to leave last night, and my Sergeant Major said to me, like, hey, I'm working on this, there's a large language model we're testing right now. And he's sitting working on tuning it. And I don't know very many Sergeant Majors in the Army that are sitting down working on tuning a large language model. And he's comparing the performance of it and giving feedback is what he's really doing. And so I think he sets the example, and our sergeants at every level and our warrant officers at every level are part of that culture. And so that's really where we try to focus, because they are the largest part of the formation. And I learned that in the special from so many good sergeants, majors, and senior NCOs in the special operations community, that that's their ethos and that's how they function. And I'm very proud to say, I think the sergeant major of the Army kind of comes from that as well. And I think he definitely is instilling that same culture.
Yeah. So speaking of hard problems, you know, something a lot of us have been worried about for a while, which is kind of coming to bear now, is kind of this counter UAS problem. You know, seeing it now appearing on the battlefield everywhere, I would say its scale and its strength. And I know that's an area that you and your team have really been trying to get your arms around and go after. But before we kind of go into how you're attacking that problem, you know, a little more specifically, kind of can you give a little bit of maybe a counter UAS background for some of the listeners who may not, you know, have a deep understanding of it, and kind of how you see how you're approaching it, you know, at the kind of macro level?
Sure, absolutely, Hondo. I think the first thing I'd start, I think it, we have to start with is what is the U in UAS? It's yeah. Unmanned. And I know everybody knows that, but I wanted to put emphasis on it. And I think it's important to just imagine that I think right now we're seeing unmanned aerial systems. We're also seeing unmanned maritime vessels, and then we're starting to see unmanned ground activity. And so as we think about the world of autonomous vehicles, autonomous aircraft, I think that unmanned piece is really, really important. And it, whether it's in single unmanned vehicles or unmanned aerial systems, or it's in swarms that are operating autonomously, thinking through solutions to that starts with that first understanding point of how is it operating unmanned? What are the control mechanisms that the programmer or the designer of this unmanned technology put into place? And the counter is all about how we build the systems that are going to defeat these. And I don't think there's any one tool. I think there's multiple tools. But at our in terms of a philosophy and how we approach it, we start with detection and trying to understand where these things are located. And I focus the brigade mostly on detection. We're very big into the detection space. But then at speed, we also have to identify what those threats are before we can precisely defeat them. And so detection and identification is a huge component of what we do. And then, of course, a lot of the community focuses on defeating the actual unmanned aerial system. And so recently, the challenge that counter UAS has really faced is the advent of one-way attacks. And so those you've heard of these probably in the Ukraine, you've heard of them. And in terms of what Iran is pushing into different areas of the globe, most concerningly into Iraq and Syria. But I think the idea that a robot essentially is operating in any domain is something that is just, we're just starting to see the initial pieces of that. And we're going to see more and more of it over the course of the next couple of years in terms of what that looks like. So this counter UAS philosophy, approach, the way that we're attacking it, these systems, I think is just really critical to the future of how we approach autonomous, counter-autonomous, anything in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's a one, you know, like many technologies, it's got lots of benefits in terms of what it allows folks to do commercially, to do good in the world. And then it's got, lots of nefarious elements to it as well. And I think your point is really well taken. We think of it right now from the air, but it's going to be one of these things that cuts across many different domains. Does the way you think about it from an intelligence perspective change per domain, or is it just kind of adapt, to the unique elements of the domain, but kind of overall sense it the same way?
I think it's a little of both. I would say yes to that question. We definitely think about the way that we do identification, and particularly the way we'll talk about data and how we approach data, in a way that's not, or that's domain agnostic. But then when you look at the detection and the defeat, I think there's a lot of facets of it that are specific to the air, and organizationally how we integrate the air and the land is absolutely critical to our approach. And so I think counter UAS is inherently a multi-domain fight. And I think because of that, this specific threat is a little bit unique, but I think we'll probably see it. A lot of different threats will be multi-domain.
I had the great opportunity last summer to visit a couple of the B docs in theater. And for listeners who don't know the acronym, that's the Base Defense Operations Centers. And Molly, I know you've spent quite a bit of time working in several of them. I was wondering if you could give our listeners a sense of what it's like to work there. I know the impression I had is it was an incredible team, brilliant, lots of energy working together. But if you could talk a little bit about what it's like to be there.
So I think that it's a 24/7 nerve center, and it's the nerve center that is the most important nerve center of protecting our forces, whether that's from land threats or air threats. Both of them are handled at the BDOC. There's day-to-day business that's handled at the Base Defense Operations Center. And what's hard about a BDOC is I think it can feel many times as sort of monotonous or routine. You're going to do a lot of things, like in a lot of jobs, you're going to do routine things routinely. But as those threats come in, and as you're doing training for those threats or actual threats come, it's moving fast. It's a very fast moving organization. So it's a team that has to really understand and be practiced. And these teams and platforms and crews have to operate together. They have to have great SOPs, and they have to understand what they're seeing on camera, what they're seeing, different intelligence feeds. They have to know what's going on when the three different networks of phones are coming in. And so there's just, I would say, a ton of information that they are processing on a routine basis. And then it spikes sometimes when there's an actual threat that's coming in. So they have to be very agile and ready to kind of handle any situation. But then I'd say that the other thing is they have to think about everything as layers. And so their defenses it's never one thing that helps us defeat these threats and helps us identify these threats. It's a layered approach. And so that's what really why they get all this information at once, is there's all these layers that are feeding them, and they have to think about, we always say defense in depth, and that's essentially saying multiple layers of defense. And so that's how they're processing it. That's how they're dealing with it. But yeah, that's kind of the abstract BDOC, but the day-to-day BDOC is busy, and it is a well-oiled machine.
Yeah, I mean, again, we all have the advantage of seeing folks downrange and all the amazing things that our soldiers and airmen and sailors and guardians, everybody else's Marines are doing downrange every day to get after this. What's your sense, right? Speed matters, scale matters in this problem. And you're constantly kind of fighting the speed and scale game. Threat moves and looks for vulnerabilities and moves. How are you looking? What kind of techniques or activities are you doing to bring in, innovation to help drive that scale and speed thing, and looking for new ideas? How do you approach that while at the same time making sure you're doing those hard jobs every day as the operational battle rhythm dictates?
Yeah, so I think we're doing a couple of things. The first thing I would mention is that we are working across CENTCOM and across ABCENT and RCENT to work across warfighting functions. And so that means working together with the air component, together with the land component. There's a whole team of protection experts and electronic warfare experts and kinetic experts. And there are routine meetings that our senior leaders are pulling together to ensure that this isn't just an intelligence approach, and this isn't just a air defense approach, and this isn't, you know, you could name them all, but it takes a multi-layer approach to deal with the problem. And so that's the first thing, are those routine collaboration spaces that we're leveraging. But then as we move through those at the senior level, one of the things we did at 513th, and that I'm seeing others do it, is build embedded data solutions or data. I've heard of tactical data exploitation teams. We call ours our Intel data solutions groups. And it's data engineers and data analysts and data scientists and developers that are sitting right with the analysts, and they're looking at the problem from a data-centric perspective. And so as they look at different detection opportunities and from the different intelligence disciplines, they're saying, how can I look at this data differently? How can I combine it? How can I make it make sense? And how can I help help the team move faster when it comes to detection? So that Intel Data Solutions group is really embedding those data scientists and data analysts at the Intel analyst level, has side by side, has been huge in terms of us solving tactical problems. And then the other thing I would mention is then there's been some efforts that CENTCOM's put together, and I think together with a couple of the DoD counterparts like Stu and Sky have put together hackathons. And these hackathons have provided opportunities to bring some of these data scientists and developers together. And when they bring them together, it's amazing what they come up with. They not only then bring other ideas together, but they bring data together, and then they drink a lot of Monster and coffee, and they don't sleep for a good 3 or 4 days. And they challenge one another to come up with hard problems. And they almost always have an analyst or an operator who is with them at the hackathon, who's really providing that vector on the problem, saying, well, this is what I need as a BDOC operator. Saying, look, I have this interface that's coming in, and I have that interface that's coming in, and I can't swivel chair to 5 different screens at once. And so those hackathons, I think, are just great in terms of bringing together problems with data scientists and developers that can come up with real practical solutions. And so I think the last one that Sky and team did was called CENTCOM Sandtrap. And I know we sent a team down, and they hacked on a solution, and now they have essentially a minimum viable product. They bring it back to our team. And so we're going to work on that for the next couple of months. So it was just like a huge shot in the arm to move forward on something. And now we've got the longer term work of figuring out how we scale it and implement it throughout our formation. So those are some of the things. I mean, I know there's a ton I could go on and on, but that's just a couple of the things that we're trying to do.
And how exciting for the teams working these issues and to work every part of the process that you outlined from detect to defeat. Last number I heard was earlier today, there have been over 160 attacks on U.S. and partner forces in theater since October 7th, which is so significant. How do those real life events impact your efforts around some of these exercises and innovation related teaming?
I think they both accelerate and decelerate them. Mm-hmm. So in some senses, when the problem is more clear and it's crystallized in the mind of the problem holder or the developer, that accelerates it. It both accelerates the urgency, but it also accelerates the vision of what you need. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, our innovation efforts, since all of these attacks, have just moved forward with a greater sense of urgency and clarity. But it also comes with challenges, because you have to really focus sometimes on the problem at hand with the tools that you have. And so that might look like having to do some swivel chair for a little while before you can go back and fix some of your there's a lot of technical debt in all of these systems to try to bring them together. So you may have a kind of a big project that you want to work on that you know could help accelerate something, but you don't have the capacity and the time because you really got to kind of solve the problem at hand. So sometimes that's a challenge. I think that's when you have to reach out to the community and reach out to the department and ask for some help. And we've been really fortunate, I think, with different partners. And that's I think, the long and short of it is there's a yin and a yang to it, I guess, or as Hondo said earlier, there's two sides of every technology.
Molly, I think you're the first person to bring up the idea of technical debt on our show. And I'm wondering if you could just quickly define what you mean by that, because it's a really important concept.
I think that for me, I define it as there's lots of tools and systems in place that do the job that we need them to do, but it might not be in the most efficient or effective manner. And so when it comes down to it, to create a solution, we've sometimes, whether it was 10 years ago or 10 days ago, we packed our way to something, we put something in place, and then it's taking us either a lot of people or a lot of money or a lot of machines to, or compute, to keep it running. So we know that's technical debt. We know there's a way that we could make it more streamlined. Maybe there's a new technology out there. And so I think when you start to layer on all of these either time expensive or compute expensive, or just kind of, I look at some of the architectures that I see just in counter UAS or in theater, and I think, man, there's a more streamlined way to do this now. But we've accrued all of this kind of debt that we're now having to keep some of the current, less streamlined, less efficient ways to do it in place.
Yeah, Molly. So, I mean, besides just the counter UAS things, I mean, you guys are always putting new tools in place. You know, you've got a ton of requirements. In terms of feedback you could give to listeners from industry out there, what are things that they're doing that you appreciate and doing well, and where are areas where they could help you help them get, you know, capability downrange faster to ease this burden of actually getting fielded capability that makes a difference?
I think so. There's lots of things that come to mind, but the one that stands out the most is the idea of data integration. As so many different industry partners are building tools and they're making a commercial solution, they're often doing it kind of in a vertical stack, if you will, or they're doing it in a way that it integrates extremely well with their own technologies. And there's oftentimes a business model for that. There's also a speed model for that. Both of those things are helping them go fast, and they're helping produce commercial value, which I think makes a lot of sense. But when you go and see a cottage industry in a base defense center, and you see four or five different tools that industry has created, and none of them have a way to actually work together at the data level in terms of they don't have APIs exposed, or they don't have any sort of standardization of their data, I think industry partners are super, super, there's lots of intelligence in these fields, and there's lots of collaboration. And so where they can collaborate with one another, where they can integrate with one another, and where they can find a way to balance that business model with an operational model so that we can integrate their data streams, integrate their interfaces, either their data interface or their actual user interface on screen, ideally both. But I think those are the places that can make a huge difference for the fight right now, but also the fight in the future.
And it's something I want to foot stomp, because we've been hearing so much, and there's a lot of industry issue in trying to contribute, help solve this problem, if you will. But the need to have interoperability across the chain itself, but even within. So not just from detect to defeat, but different defeat systems as well, for example. And Molly, with that, we've talked about how busy you are right now, so we don't want to keep you too long, but we did want to ask, how are your teams doing? Is morale okay these days?
Oh yeah, morale is really good. I think that this brigade and Arsen as a whole, and SETCOM as a whole, I think I would say that just constantly, based on the leadership and of empowerment that I see from General Carrillo down to General Frank and certainly down to our level, I see that actually as that helps morale an awful lot, and that the soldiers love the idea that people, partnerships, and innovation is the focus. And so I think the soldiers like to be able to contribute to solutions and contribute to getting after the enemy. And so I think that is a natural help to morale. We're all busy, and that's definitely can be a challenge, but I think soldiers are doing well.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, thank you, Molly, for taking time out of your busy day to talk to our listeners. And more importantly, thanks for all the work you're doing and your leadership in this area.
Great. Thanks, Lauren. Thanks, Hondo.
All right, Molly. Awesome.
You've been listening to Building the Base, a podcast by Lauren Badula and Hondo Gertz. Remember to subscribe and share wherever you're listening. Leave a comment to suggest a guest. And for up-to-date insights on the show, join our newsletter at www.buildingthebase.org. That's www.buildingthebase.org.